Hello, everyone, and happy July. Yes, we took a month off during the month of June. Yes, even your pediatricians do sometimes like to take a vacation. But we are back in the heat of summer, and our original scheduled broadcast, we had to do a little bit of a change, but you know, as everyone knows, pediatricians are, if nothing, we are very adaptable. And we called up a very special guest, which first, I should probably welcome and say happy. Granted, I saw you last week, but hello, Scott. How are you doing?
We are great. We are great. We all met at the House of Delegates. We had our special guest. I won't give it away quite yet. But you and I saw our special guest at the House of Delegates in Chicago. We were very happy. I agree with you. We all need a little bit of a vacation and put our feet up. Or I actually took a little bit of vacation and went with my grandkids to on an Amtrak train. They'd just never been on a train before, so they were tickled to death. But we had a happy, happy time and excited to get back in, as we say in Oklahoma, maybe New Mexico too. Happy to get back in the saddle.
All right. Yes, after our smoky start to Chicago, but it turned out beautiful by the end of it. But let's waste no time. I want to thank our guest for answering my text at about 5 o'clock this evening, saying, "Hey, what are you doing at 7:30?
Eastern time."
Yes. And getting pulled into this discussion. But without further ado, I want to welcome the current president of the American College of Osteopathic Pediatricians, Dr. Tyree Winters. Ty, how are you doing?
Hey, everybody. I'm doing good. Thanks for the invite.
The crowd goes wild.
You know you have an open invitation into our broadcast booth. So anytime you wanna...
And he knows how you and I can call an audible.
Yes.
Exactly.
So we're going to save the talk about summer sports injuries and things like that for a later date. And we're going to talk about something that, as you can tell, we're all in pretty good moods, but we're going to talk about something that is both a little bit distressing, but also I think a little bit hopeful in the fact that we have ideas on how to make it better. And we're going to discuss the state of our profession at this time. And in the fact that while DOs are increasingly joining the realm of pediatrics, or at least be increasing to be the in the percentage of residents or fourth graduate medical students who match to pediatrics, it is not an unknown thing to say that the workforce of pediatricians is shrinking. And what can we do about it? How can we encourage those of you who are listening to this, whether you are a practicing physician, to encourage med students to go into pediatrics, or you're a med student thinking, hey, what do I want to do? What can we do to encourage you all to come and join the land of the little people, and where it's okay to watch cartoons and play games and wear fun colors and join the world of pediatrics? So I could think of no better person to call on a moment's notice than the president of our college. So Dr. Winters, I want to open the floor to you because I know you have a lot of inside info as to where we are as a profession, where we're headed, and what we can do to right this ship. So I'm going to give the floor to you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And thank you. I think it's also just level set the audience as well. In my professional role, I am the vice chair of education as well as the director of graduate medical education for Nemours Children's Hospital in Delaware Valley, which is in Wilmington, Delaware, but then also the associate designated institutional official for Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. To that question, I have the privilege of being able to sit on and serving a multiple national task force that's focused in on the shortage that we're starting to see in a pediatric workforce. And this is across the board. So whether it is for general pediatricians or pediatricians who are subspecialists, we're starting to see a decline in the number of candidates from American or U.S. allopathic graduates, as well as U.S. osteopathic graduates. We are still seeing an increase in the amount of students that graduate or graduates from international medical schools who are born outside of this country. With that being said, we would still have to have a continued increase in those individuals that have graduated from international medical schools who are U.S. citizens to continue to keep entering into our training programs in order to meet the need that we know that will continue to rise as we are seeing populations grow within this country, as well as seeing the workforce that we currently have that are starting to either retire or change and leave out of medicine as a whole. All right. Why is that important? And I'm just laughing at Scott Cyrus just playing to himself as a recent.
He said retirement, you know. I'm 7 months out of retirement from practice.
And I love that, though, because, I mean, that's the ultimate goal, right? Is that we can enjoy retirement. And so I'm very proud of you to be able to enjoy retirement. I think the most important thing about this is, why is it super important? And why I brought up, oh, well, we're seeing a decline in two groups, which is the USDO and USMD graduates, but we're seeing an increase in the non-US citizen and national medical grad, is because in our current political environment in this country, we know that it is quite difficult for students who or graduates from international medical schools who are non-US citizens to be able to have or obtain visas to either train in our training programs or to be able to practice once they finish training. So we can't even depend necessarily on that group to continue to keep filling the need for the shortage. So that's the first thing. Even though they are, all of the groups that I have made mention of are important parts of this group. Why it's important for us is as DOs within this community, especially DOs who are pediatricians, is because for over the past decade, we had an increase in the amount of students that were entering into pediatrics. And for a while over this decade, as you started to see the USMD graduates starting to decline, the USDO graduates were increasing. And a lot of programs were really excited and depending on, quite frankly, our graduates to be able to help meet some of these needs in the training programs. But now that we're starting to see that even in that situation, we're starting to see that it's leveling out and even in some sense starting to have a slight decline, that's making more concern. And we're also seeing now that it's been a while since, and I'm talking about several years, that pediatrics was not one of the top three specialties that our USDO graduates went into. So it's a lot of just trying to set the environment for why there is a concern. When we're looking at these national task force, the focus has been on how can we get all of those different groups, whether it's U.S. trained physicians, and so that includes the USMD and DO, versus even the non-U.S. and U.S. citizens that went to international medical graduate schools to be able to enter into pediatrics. And we can talk a little bit more about why we are seeing a decline, but I wanted to make sure that I at least level set to your first question of like, why are we starting to see this decline?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, that's a great point. And, you know, there's a huge concern about the cost of medical education versus the, you know, the amount of loans that the students now have to pay off. And what, as you go into pediatrics, you are looked at a large population, typically a Medicaid population, which typically does not pay to the highest amount. How do you see that filtering into this equation?
I mean, that's definitely a factor that comes into play, which is the financial burden that our students are taking on, regardless of if you went to any U.S. medical school, a U.S. citizen who went to an international medical school. The average debt for medical students are steadily increasing. It's 300, getting even closer to $400,000 of student loan debt that these students are taking out, which is concerning, number one. And when you see that the average salary for a pediatrician hasn't really moved that much in terms of the same amount that it's due. And I think, you know, it depends on the sources that you're looking at. They all vary in range, but at somewhere, and this is looking at from regardless of if you are at more of a mid to later career physician, pediatrician to early pediatrician, just looking at the average of it, you're somewhere averaging still about like in the mid 200 range. And that's looking at people who have been doing this work for over a decade plus. And when you add in pediatric subspecialties, especially some of the subspecialties that are non-procedural based, they're even making potentially lower than that. So it's quite difficult. But I will also say, too, there are some other challenges that come into play. One of those challenges is, to Jason's point, which you made earlier, like, oh, you don't want to dress and beautiful loud colors and play with rainbows and stickers and all these different type of things, is that professional identity formation that a lot of people have talked about, which is that pediatrics is not as a intellectual or academically challenging field, which all three of us know is a complete and utter falsehood.
Yes.
But when you have that, yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And let me clarify. It's not all rainbows and butterflies. And yes, there is. I mean, pediatric medicine is an art form in all of itself, because not only are you trying to get to the bottom and diagnose and treat, you're trying to get it out of a 7-year old, or in my case, getting it out of
a
7-pounder, right? Yeah. So like, I had a question, and hold on, it'll come back to me. I promise it will.
You bring up an excellent point. Most of our patients can't tell us what's wrong with them. The ability to understand what's going on with this patient without them really able to communicate with us is an art and a talent. And especially in your world, Jason, they don't talk to you for the entire visit of maybe 60, 90 days that they may be in your NICU. And then you have to find a physician who's willing to take that patient post NICU care of a extremely premature child. That was the thing that I did. They knew me at the NICU. They knew I would take the patient. No matter what was delivered to me, I enjoyed that intellectual challenge. I knew that if they had a heart defect, if they had an abdominal defect, if they had a spinal defect, whatever that was, they were born without a corpus callosum. I saw that as a challenge. Every child that came out of the NICU, out of the PICU, wrote their own book. They wrote a study of one, if you will. But it was a passion for me as a general pediatrician to take care of these kids, and whether they had epidermolysis bullosa or, like I said, absent corpus callosum. I knew there was going to be challenges for that child, but I felt like you know, they needed a medical home.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that you're a diminishing breed, because I can tell you, we have trouble sometimes finding pediatricians who are willing to take our NICU graduates, because of the fact of the labor versus the, you know, the return is, it's not, you know, it's hard. But I also want to take a second, that this is the point I wanted to make to those of you who are listening. This is still such a this is such a rewarding field to get into. And I know, like, we are talking about the dirty underbelly of it, and maybe why, like, there's reasons why we're a diminishing field, but it is such a rewarding field. So if you have chosen pediatrics as a profession, or if you're considering matching into pediatrics, or a fourth year who's working on matching into pediatrics, you are choosing a very noble field. And continue it, because also you're going to be joining an amazing ACOP family that is, you know, we're here to embrace and help. And so I just wanted to get that out. And now, Ty, I'm going to no longer interrupt you.
No, it's now. Totally. Yes, I know. Trust me, I've been around you long enough to know that. But no, what I was going to say is that to both of your points, you just provided the absolute example of what we are missing, which is the ability to have mentors in these spaces. So before, when we were doing the pre-meeting for this podcast, we were having a discussion that I really felt should have been and needs to be on this podcast, which is the fact that we do not have, across the board in all medical schools, by the way, a lot of or a good number of representation of pediatric faculty members that are present with the medical schools. And if we do, what we tend to find is that they are not faculty members that tend to hold more senior roles within the medical school. And it's not to say that there's this kind of vendetta against people, or that there's no against pediatricians, or there's no pediatricians that are in medical schools that are within higher studies. I'm not saying that absolutely at all. But what we have discovered when kind of doing this deeper dive along these national task force has been the lack of mentorship to be able to help students to be exposed to pediatrics, because pediatrics typically are held in a special population type of curriculum, or if they are integrated within the curriculum of the preclinical years of medical school, they're usually given like 3 or 4 hours at a time to be able to be included in and say, like, hey, here's some pediatric considerations. But it really doesn't lend to being able to have that exposure. And when they go out into their clinical years, one of the things that really struggles with are one of the things that our osteopathic medical schools and our more community-based allopathic medical schools struggle with is being able to have adequate opportunities for our students to be able to have all of the different aspects of pediatrics and that training for their clerkship. So they may not have the ability to have access to go into a tertiary or quaternary children's hospital to be able to do their clerkship. They may not even have the opportunity to be able to do inpatient service. So the only thing that they've been exposed to is outpatient service. I can tell you, even as a graduate from Ohio University, I know it's now Heritage, but I still call it Ohio University College of Osteopathic Medicine because I'm that old enough to be able to remember when it was just UCOM. My 4 weeks of pediatric clerkship experience was in a pediatric emergency department. And if I was not interested in going to pediatrics, that was all that I had needed for my entire medical school career of exposure to pediatrics. And it wasn't because I felt like my med school was like, oh, you don't need pediatrics, but it was just not a lot of opportunities to go around to be able to expose students to. And so I think in that regards, that's one of the things that, how do we provide those opportunities for students to be able to know, hey, all of the things that both you Scott and Jason, what you both talked about with the work that we do as pediatricians, how we have to have such a rewarding and challenging clinical practice. How do we show, like, you know, there's so much more. I have told so many of my students, go ahead.
One of the things, and you brought up one of the things that I always thought was interesting.
Yes.
When I was in medical school, and I don't know if it's the same at all the other medical schools, but like when you're doing your rotations, like you're going to have your like adult cardiology, your adult, but then you're limited to the number of weeks you can do peds rotations. But if I said I wanted to do a peds cardiology rotation and count it as my cardiology rotation, they're like, no, that's going to count towards your peds weeks. And it's like, but if you're going to show medical students the expanse of the adult world, we have to be able to do that the same. If someone comes to you in the third year and they say, I am sure I want to do peds, but I am not sure what realm, there should be no reason why they can't say that I'm going to do a PGI rotation, learn about Crohn's, learn about UC, learn about, you know, functional constipation, learn about anorectal malformations. We're talking about all great lunch things here. But learn about these things, and it's still GI related. It's still GI. It's just GI in the world they want to live in. What can we do? I will say this, you know, what can we do as a college to help advocate to say that this should count? Like this, you need to be able, like, if you're going to expose the students to the wide realm of adult medicine, but you have a student who you know is interested in peds, why can't they just be exposed to that same world, but in pediatrics?
You brought up a valid point, Jason. I think it's something that Scott probably knows best between all of us, which is, one, you have, and I didn't learn this until moving up higher and higher in medical education leadership, you have a finite amount of time to cram so much in. And there are so many different pressing interests that lie among all of the things that you want to expose your students to. And so in that regards, there are certain criteria that needs to be met, certain regulations based off of organizations such as COCA, who accredits the comms for the undergraduate experience, to be able to say, like, this individual will come out as a competent osteopathic physician who can then go on to training in whatever area subspecialty. So those are some of the competing interests that lie. I think the most important thing as a college that we need to do is to, one, be able to understand more so how the sausage get made. What I have learned in doing some of this work, and part of this work is my own scholarly work that I have been doing that I have interest in within my career for medical education scholarship, has been trying to understand how is it a way for us to be able to more streamline all of the experiences of a medical student, of an osteopathic medical student. So when they come out, everyone has typically the same type of educational experience. Go ahead.
I don't know why this just came to me, and I don't know, this is probably not physically or feasibly possible in the medical school world at all. But when you go to college, undergraduate college, you declare a major.
Yep.
You declare a, like, this is what I want to do. You have those same, especially if you go to, like, you know, me, I went to a liberal arts school. If you have this, you have the same baseline requirements that everyone has to do, but then the rest of your stuff is geared towards your major. Why isn't a field that is vast as medicine? Because even like in law school, you can early specialize in, like, I want to go into torts and reforms. I want to go into constitutional law. I want to go into this. And you get your pre-clinical, and then your clinical is focused on your major. has there ever been a look, and this is to both Scott and Ty, of like allowing medical students to declare a major and be like, I will take my preclinical years to learn what I need to know to pass my licensing exams, and I will take some base, you know, base rotations, because you need to have some base rotations. But like, if my major, if my declared major is pediatrics, let's take away pediatrics. If my declared major is general surgery, it makes a whole hell of a lot more sense for me to do a lot of different surgical rotations than to go spend time in geriatrics or go spend time in this field, because I need to know what to be successful in my, especially as residency training gets shrunk down.
Students are going to focus their attention on that examination because that's a barrier examination. They do not get past that examination. They do not go past go. They do not collect $200. And that becomes an issue because the amount of pediatrics that is crossed in the Comlex 1, it is concerning. And how they present information for pediatrics on Comlex 1 is very concerning, because it's sometimes very focused on developmental questions and such, to understand, you know, what are the characteristics of a normal 6-month-old or 8-month-old or 9-month-old, whatever. And we really do have when you look at the systems, and that's how they report out Comlex, is like how well did they do in respiratory or GI. They never report out how well they did in pediatrics.
But no, they don't.
I will tell you like this, though. I think a couple of factors to the matter. So Jason's answer to your question, in UME space, there are curricula that's set up to be able to focus in on more of a primary care focus, right? Where you could actually petition to be able to have special curriculum to be able to have it where it's focused in on primary care and to be able to finish out a little bit earlier, etc. There's a lot of different nuanced ways and things around it. Also think too, it's like, just because you may be going into a specific area for your training for graduate medical education, I still think that it's so much space that's needed for that UME exposure as well, even if you don't go into it. I think one of the best examples that I could think of is my initial research that I've ever did that was published, got me my PubMed publication, was in geriatrics, in UME, in my undergraduate experience, even though I had zero interest in geriatrics, but I had interest in other area, and I got a chance to see how that played out in terms of cortisol levels playing a part into stress and caregiving. But what I was going to say is that in this regard, and something similar to what Scott had said, which is, I think the most important thing for us is to really be able to do two things. Is one, get a chance to be able to have an open mind as a college to learn about how things are done, whether it's done on the osteopathic side, whether it's done on the allopathic side, and then being able to glean and learn from each other, or learn from each side and be able to figure out what are ways that we can try to move forward, understanding what is all on stake. Because I think it's very easy for us to say, like, you know, you need to increase pediatrics. Why are we only doing 4 weeks of pediatric clerkship? We should be doing 6 weeks similar to our counterparts. Mm-hmm. But then I also understand too that, well, you have to take 2 weeks from someplace else. Where are you going to take those 2 weeks from someplace else at? And how do you manage that? And what does that look like? And do you even have the resources to be able to undertake that? Furthermore, similar to what you had made a point of within for college, right? You said you were a liberal arts major. I was a liberal arts major. I was a psychology major. As a psychology major at University of Michigan, I can tell you,
it's like the school up north,
the best school. As a psychology major, I can tell you my curriculum, my design, everything that I had did was probably very, like, was similar but varied compared to maybe somebody who went to an inferior school like Ohio State University.
I'm going to have to separate you two.
I feel attacked right now.
But with that being said, back to my point, that when you look at how a degree in psychology from University of Michigan versus a degree in psychology from Ohio State, that even though there are differences in the way that the curriculum came out and how we went through, we still were conferred degrees in psychology that I can guarantee you that both institutions who were accredited by the similar institution I accredited, higher education institutions, will say you came out and did this. Very similar to all of the different comms, to all of the different other schools of medicine, which is, we still confer you with this DO or MD degree, and we still confer that you are ready to enter into these graduate training programs. Regardless or not, you're not trying to focus in on a licensure exam that just says that you have the ability to be able to be, to receive a license, a medical license, to be able to practice medicine. But we all know that programs tend to use these licensure exams as a way to be able to determine whether or not one will be able to enter in into a program, because those graduate medical programs are going to be, I don't want to use the word judge, but are going to be evaluated based off of how many people can pass that board exam once they finish their program the first time around.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, and then Scott, I will hand the mic over to you, I promise. But, you know, especially in the U.S., there has been a culture shift to where you are determining kind of like your career path earlier and earlier and earlier, right? And so, you know, like, it used to be that the most common major in undergraduate college was undecided, right? Like, you were undecided. You came in, you're going to do your freshman year of general studies courses. And now it almost feels like in eighth grade, they're asking, they're like, all right, what do you want to do as a profession? And now we're going to cater your high school to this. So do you think that maybe, and you can speak in your unofficial capacity for both of you, do you think that maybe that there is a point that complex has to look at it and go, especially as we're shortening, you know, we're starting to talk about shortening postgraduate training, right? So like pediatric fellowships are talking about going to this 2-year clinical-only fellowship where there's no academic...
Optional.
You know, yes, optional. But you've heard that there are some programs that are only going to accept 3 years. Some programs are only going to accept 2 years. Some are going to accept one or two. But as they're sitting here and trying to streamline the training, is there going to become a point that we also have to streamline the credentialing and the education? Like, do we have to start treating professional schools more like undergraduate schools in it? Like, you're gonna have, like, do you see that that might have to be a shift, like, for us to be able to maintain our workforce? Like, people are determining earlier and earlier what their career path is in life. Mm-hmm. That maybe, like, we do have to have something like the undecided in medical school and the undecided, and then for the licensing exams, to then reflect that, to where, like, if your major was in internal medicine, you're not going to have pediatric questions. If your major is in pediatrics, you're not going to have geriatrics questions. Like, do you think that there's going to be a time that, and Scott, I can see you're shaking your head, but do you think there's going to be a time that we're going to have to do that in order
No. I would highly suggest that we not ever do that. Because when you...
Like, I can understand you highly suggesting it.
Well,
but do you think that the world, like the culture, may force us?
No, I still don't think that. Because Ty, Jason, and Scott, if we chose to go back to a different residency, we have the basic fundamental knowledge of medicine. Mm-hmm. And we have the ability to pivot, call an audible, whatever you want to say. But I have a good friend of mine that went into OB-GYN, or went into family practice with an OB-GYN emphasis, and really liked the OB-GYN side of it. Because he had the basics, he went into an OB-GYN residency. Then he really liked the fact that when the anesthesiologist came in and did epidurals, he really kind of got fascinated by that and ended up in an anesthesiology residency. And after the anesthesiology residency, went into a pain management fellowship. Now, we may all agree that that is way overeducated. But because he had the basic fundamental knowledge that all medical students should come out of medical school with, he had the ability to pivot multiple times, granted.
And then he worked for 2 years and retired because he was 70.
Maybe so, and had a resident salary for 10 years. We all know what that's like. But I believe we have to have that fundamental knowledge. And if we try to alter that in medical school, then we will really truly alter a career paths in the big picture. I think there's a fundamental knowledge, but what we have to realize in pediatrics is we as a college, a mentor, have to understand that there are challenges and when I talked about taking the NICU graduates and I talked about the PICU graduates, I looked at those as challenges. They kept me, you know, they really truly kept me alive. They kept me challenged. Each one of these children wrote their own chapter in a book that was my career. And I looked at that as phenomenal. I had so much positive feedback from my, not only my patients, but people around me, my colleagues, neurologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists. They all knew when I called them, they knew that, you know, I had my patient at interest. And it was a very, very challenging, yes, but by far on the other side, rewarding. And I just think that we need to expand the knowledge of the rewarding side of pediatrics. Yeah, I had my loans to pay off. I had my financial, you know, challenges, and I know that, you know, Medicaid is can be challenging. But when you have your patient at in the focus, in the crosshairs, you really truly don't worry about the money. They come to you beyond your capacity.
I want to switch gears here. I am blessed with sitting here with two presidents of the ACOP. I'm about to be president of the ACOP.
Woo-hoo.
God help us all. I want to ask two questions to both of you. But as leaders of this organization, I want to, like, hear from you about how you have heard that the ACOP in particular has adapted and grown, and the challenges that you saw when you came in and how you saw the organization grow and change during your time as president. So I guess we'll start with Scott.
It was such a privilege to serve as ACOP president. You know, when an organization like the American College of Osteopathic Pediatricians gives you the privilege to serve at it as its president, it is a true honor. And we both know, I think Ty and I both know, we don't get here by ourselves. We stand on the shoulders of those that have served before us. And mentors, there's an expectation. And you live up to it because there's really not a lot of choice, to tell you the truth. You don't want to fall short. I was, I followed Carl Backus, and we talked about Carl. What a great president he was. And I feel like the college was in great hands, and I really felt that I needed to take the college forward, in continuing medical education, to take the college forward in a political stance, an advocacy stance, that we advocated for our children on a national, on a state, and a local front. It was an amazing experience to be able to be surrounded by so many up-and-coming leaders, because we all were pulling for the idea that we believed in children's health, we believed in children's advocacy, we believed in the things that were right for our population. We believed in holding our residents accountable. That was the other thing. We wanted them and those that went into fellowships, be it allergy or immunology or wherever, we wanted to make sure that they, in fact, were capable of practicing independently, and they were accountable to their patients. Their focus was on that population that really didn't have a voice. They didn't vote. They couldn't many times tell you what was wrong with them. And it was my focus to make sure that we represented those that were in a situation where they could only represent their illnesses, their situations, but we could recognize them, we could diagnose them, we could help them and be able to grow and move into adulthood. So it was really a privilege for me to work with our administration, work with our board, and I looked at it as a real privilege and an honor to serve the ACOP.
Oh, that was amazing. Yes, no, thank you, Scott. I just love to be able to get a chance to listen to you and learn from you, because obviously your shoulder is one of those shoulders that I stand on in this role as president. I think the kind of going back to initially the question that was asked, I walked into this presidency with some very unique challenges. Not only the unique challenge of seeing a workforce that was starting to dwindle for pediatrics, but also a governmental administration that has set many policies that have been against the children of this country and healthcare of this country. So regardless or not of, I recognize and understand that this organization represents so many different osteopathic pediatricians who have so many different viewpoints. But I think the one common thread that we all can agree on is we are advocates for our children, our patients and their families, and the ability for them to be able to receive adequate, evidence-based, safe, medical guidelines and practices. And so that initially was what I had to walk into of seeing an attack on some of the fundamental things that we have held dear to us as a college. Now, also the things that we have to look into that I was also challenged, but in a great way, was how do we expand the reach of our college to include individuals that may not even recognize that this college still fights for them, still advocates for them on a day-to-day basis, even when they don't know that there is this college that is fighting for them. We've just had a summit that I was invited to attend on the 10th anniversary of the single accreditation of government medical education programs with the ACG.
Woo-hoo.
Well, I tell you, the thing is that within that regards, it came with challenges, but it also came with some things that were also helpful and beneficial, right? One of those things that was helpful and beneficial was, until this merger, osteopathic pediatricians who were boarded by the American Osteopathic Board of Pediatrics were not allowed to be program leaders in ACGME programs. That changed because we had this single accreditation system. And so it did allow for certain things to be able to change. We also started to see programs that were entering, that were accepting more DOs. The problem that we also wind up finding is that it created this kind of gap in between how osteopathic pediatricians and their training, whether it was from UME, so undergraduate medical education training, to continue medical education, it was a gap. And we lost a lot of individuals who recognized, like, hey, we're here, we're still around, we're still supporting you. So I was very fortunate to take that challenge to be able to say, okay, how can we make sure that we are putting ACOP back on the radar of individuals who may have not either known or may have forgotten that we are present, that we're here. And so part of that has been where the ACOP has now been recognized by several national organizations as a partner in trying to work on the task force, national task force. So we have representatives, not just myself as the president, but we have our student trustees who are representing on certain task force to be able to provide that osteopathic medical student voice. We have several of our osteopathic residents and fellows that are representing as well, who are also part of the ACOP. We have been able to do webinars and to be able to provide upcoming academic presentations within national conferences where we have partnered with to advocate and talk about the osteopathic pediatrician, our training, our unique training, and the barriers and challenges that come along with operating in the space of a single accreditation system. So with that being said, I'm excited because I was able to bring part of this, part of our work in the forefront, understanding that we are not just solely just an academic organization. We are an organization that has encompasses so many individuals, community pediatricians, pediatricians who work in administration all over the place. So my thought process is I'm starting to go towards the point of passing the torch over in about 8 to 9 months. I would be remiss to not see the work that I'm doing and talk with the incoming president to be able to figure out what is your platform? The same way that Jamie Goldstein, who was our immediate past president, was afforded me the opportunity to talk about my platform. So that way it can be a bridge and we can work towards this.
Yeah. But I think that what's important is, as kind of Ty mentioned and at least alluded to, is that we take the torch forward from our predecessors. And because we believe in this college, we believe in its mission, we believe in its leadership, we believe in its direction. And I think that that is many times unique, because many, many organizations have leaders that have their own agenda. And it almost becomes schizophrenic, if you will, because they lead one way, they lead another way. I have never seen this organization be so unified. And you take the torch as it is passed off to me from Carl and beyond, to be so unified in its direction, to support DO pediatricians, to recognize the commonality of problems between allopathic pediatricians and osteopathic pediatricians, because we do have common issues, common problems. We advocate for our children in common ways, but we yet support osteopathic education and residencies and support our residents as they try to, you know, specialize in the areas that they are interested in, be it neonatology, cardiology, wherever. I know that the stress of pediatrics is difficult, it is great, but yet as a pediatrician, I love the challenges because it came with rewards. Where my children would thrive to be able to grow big enough to get their heart fixed, and then they were able to, you know, be successful in school and be successful in society, and it really filled me with a sense of true satisfaction that I was called to this profession for a reason. And, you know, I know there was a lot of crazy tough days, but I never got burned out. I never got burned out.
Yeah.
Even when I sold my practice, I wasn't burned out. It was just the right time to do it. And
it's because you're ancient.
I know. I learned on a stone tablet, but.
I don't want to say that now because we're friends.
Yeah.
I would not have said that when I was staying in his guest room. I would have been like, hey, you're ancient. Then it was, you're so generous.
This last month, I had a third-year medical student, soon to be a fourth-year, stayed at my house. You know, I was actually at the House of Delegates, and I've got somebody who's going to be staying in my house, you know, soon.
Yeah, just so you know, listeners, if you're staying at his house and he's gone, you can stay in the garage. Like, it's great.
Yeah, we've got, like I said, we've got plenty of room and a hot tub and swimming pool. So,
this is
how I get back.
Tyree, you got a heated swimming pool and a hot tub that our listeners are going to be able to use?
Absolutely not.
But I'd be willing to share. I'm willing to share because my predecessor was willing to share with me.
Yes.
Be it their knowledge, their time, their wisdom, whatever it was, they were willing to share. And yes. I want to do the same. So,
yes.
And that's the beautiful thing about the pediatric osteopathic pediatric practice.
Yeah. I was going to say, as we bring her back to family here, the purpose of this talk was to talk about where pediatric world is, but also where the ACOP is here to fix it. Like, there's a lot of things that are going on, but the ACOP is here to support you in any way that we can.
Right.
But we're also here hoping that you will support the future of the ACOP. So
the future of pediatrics.
Yes. And the AOF, because I have to say that, because one of my co-host is the immediate past president of the AOF. Support your college, support your foundations, support your students.
For you. That's the thing. We give back from the AOF, from the ACOP, we give back to you because you're that important to us and to your patients. So I would say, I really want to thank Ty. You know, you're a phenomenal individual. I want to thank you for inviting me to join the nationwide question group, or I like the question group because we have three groups, one of which is I'm part of group two that says, how can allopathic physicians, osteopathic physicians change the attitudes of students to get more of a workforce in pediatrics? And we want more pediatricians in our workforce because we all know children are not little adults, and we need that. They need that. Our patients need that.
Exactly.
And it's heartfelt to me, especially for somebody who was oriented to a totally different profession. And, you know, as I say many times, I didn't pick pediatrics. Pediatrics picked me. And I could not be more blessed to be able to be a part of this profession. And we need to enlighten people and medical students to say, this is a rewarding profession. It is challenging. No, there's no profession that in medicine that's not challenging, but this is truly rewarding because of the length of the time you take care of your patients. You see them grow. You advise them. You literally many times are a part of their family, and I am blessed to be to have the honor to have taken care of so many children in my neck of the woods, if you will.
Yes. Well, as Lawrence O'Donnell would say, I think that seems like the last word. However, I do want to offer the last word to our special guest, Tyree Winters, before we head out.
Yes, and I would say, you know, tip your waiters. No, just kidding. Try the veal.
You're here all week.
We're here all week. No, but a final word that I would definitely want everybody to know and appreciate, which is there is a lot of challenges that occur. But I also want to reiterate, there was also a lot of challenges that have been present in pediatrics for so long. This is not anything new under the sun. We have seen before where we have had a dearth of individuals going into the field. Is it concerning because of the fact that we also are having a current workforce that is starting to become at a point where they're ready to retire? Of course, that is concerning, but it also is reassuring to know that just because we are seeing individuals that are we're seeing challenges, we have always as a profession rose to those challenges. One of the reasons why I remain to be a proud DO is because I know that I'm part of a profession that, unlike with the Flexner report, we never had issues. We've always held open the doors for individuals that were seen upon as being the quote-unquote non-traditional student, i.e. a white cisgender male. We had female physicians enter into the first class of osteopathic medicine. We have had African-Americans enter into the field of osteopathic medicine without meaning to have a college that was specifically for African Americans. So I'm a firm believer that we have always rose to the occasion. We've always looked to see a higher calling, which is to take care of our patients, to have a holistic approach. And as long as I have breath in my body, I will continue to make sure that our profession is challenged and held to a standard, not only from the osteopathic side, but also for osteopathic pediatricians. It is something that I think is super important that we hold on to. And there are so many different identities that we can understand and see and why it's super important for us. So to wrap everything up, I just want to thank you both for the opportunity to be able to sit on this podcast yet again to talk about an important topic, but also just to be able just to commune with two presidents of the ACOP.
You bet.
I know. I have a couple of my mentors here at my side and at my mercy, and I'm kind of enjoying it.
You mentioned about challenges. You know, I always say without challenges, you cannot have rewards.
Yes, exactly.
100%. I want to thank both of you for coming on to what has turned into a very important podcast. So I hope everyone listens to it. But also just for everything you do for the ACOP. And for those of you who are listening, get ready to listen to the August podcast. Who knows what's going to happen? I actually don't, because I haven't planned it yet. But I want to thank you all. And from the ACOP, best of health, best of love, and we will see you next month.
The ACOP PEDScast podcast series is the official podcast of the American College of Osteopathic Pediatricians. Your hosts are Jason Jackson Dio and Scott Cyrus Dio. Original music by James Cyrus of Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you have any requests for topics or you'd like to be a guest on the PEDScast podcast series, please email us at PEDScast, PEDScast, @acopeds.org.